Okay, so let's talk about the middle of the parsha a bit. There's so much in this parsha. Now, Avram has this strange... we just started Zeb, if you want to... he has this strange deja vu thing going on, which all the Mepharshim are quite bothered by. Why exactly does he go to Avimelech, lie again about his wife, say that she's his sister, go through the same ruse again, we go through the same thing, it just happens. Okay, fine. I want to just focus on one little point. We focused on one aspect of it last year, I want to focus on a different aspect of it this year. Avimelech turns to God with righteous indignation and says, what do you want from me? What are you so angry with me? I didn't know. If I had known that she was his wife, I wouldn't have done it. I did it to my slave. And God says, yeah, sort of. Yeah, you're right. Okay, that's why I didn't kill you. But, you know, it's not like total innocence. And Rosenzweig notes that here there is this, like, interesting thing going on, right, where people's self-perception is never, right, is never quite the truth. And here, like, Avimelech's self-perception is that he's perfect, right? And God is like, look, yes and no. And he forces him to go to Avram and says, look, if you want to be saved, you have to go to Avram, and he will daven for you, and that will save you. And then in the process, Avram tells him, when he says, well, why did you do this? He says, ki ein yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh. There was no fear of God here. So, it's not that you're guilty, but Hashem doesn't let him get off scot-free. He forces him to go through an educational moment where Avram informs him, you're not as righteous as you think you are. Now, we noted last year that Yirat Elokim, often Tanakh, does not necessarily mean fear of God, per se. It means,
just,
yeah, like some sort of natural morality or something like that, because it's used in all these contexts with people who there's no assumption they should know God, per se. Right? So it means more like generic... speaking, at least that's more the modern approach to it. But I want to share with you the Malbim, because the Malbim really doesn't take that approach at all. The Malbim has a very different read of these psukim, which is interesting both in Parshanut. It's also interesting as it is clearly, very clearly, a Parshan speaking to his cultural moment. That doesn't mean it's a wrong parshanut, but it means you can tell that he's also speaking to his cultural moment. It happens to be the same cultural moment we are in, which is why it's important to read. At least this is how I understand the Malbim, right? The Malbim is dealing with the following question, right? Once I start talking in these terms, like, is Yirat Elokim really God, or is it natural morality, or some sort of consensus morality, or whatever, in the modern world, post-enlightenment and things like that, where religion often gets a bad rap on these issues, and there's claims that philosophy or just culture can do a better job at morality, if there is morality, than religion. But religion is definitely not seen as essential to morality. The Malbim responds and says that this pasuk tells you that it's not true, the way he reads this. By the way, the notion that religion was absolutely central to morality wasn't just like a from thing, right? But I'll talk about that in just a minute. So this is what the Malbim says. He says, "Vayomer Avram, ki amarti rak ein yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh." He says, "Hodielo." This is what he told Avimelech. She gam im nireh ish o'am shu pilosof gadol v'chakak lo nimosim yisharim. Even if you find a philosopher or a whole philosophical nation that has made for themselves moral principles, moral laws. And they follow good midos because of their intellect. Right? Like Ben Franklin or something. Right? Right? Ben Franklin has backdoor made it very much into the Jewish moral tradition. Right? I never told you this. Have you ever go around like from school, like from me school, sometimes they'll have like the... what is it, like the 13 midos of Yisrael Salanter or something, yeah, on the wall? Those are the 13 midos of Ben Franklin. Because it's not Yisrael Salanter, it's a Talmud of his, right? Who in the book writes, Ra'iti l'chacham echad amerikai b'shem Benjamin Franklin, right? And then he quotes from Franklin in his ethical writings. So if you have a person like that, fun times. B'chol zeh, you can't really rely on those people. tisitu davato, tisitu davato lasot ra, because when his desires will entice him to do evil, shitamid yigvar sichlal tavato. Right? Don't believe that he's always going to be able to conquer his intellect. Conquer his desires with his intellect. Ki behefech. The opposite is true. A tivayer bo esh tavato al eshet chen ohon reyu. When he's overcome by desire for a woman who's married someone else or his friend's wealth, bein roeh, and nobody's looking. As gam sichlo yelech sholel or tzoch v'den of lasod kol ra. His intellect also will, right, come up with some justification and jump towards that. Rakoch echad nimtza b'nevesh ha'adam asher bo nuchal l'vtoch shlo nechta. There's only thing. One thing which can really keep people from sinning, it's the fear in your soul. And fear, the most likely you're going to have that will actually be effective, you know, in private, is a specific type called fear of God. Etc. Now, like I said, I think the Malbim is responding to his moment, right? A belief in which religion was no longer viewed as necessary for morality. The Malbim is reading into this pasuk and saying, I don't think that's true, right? Because as much as you might be philosophically committed to something, there is a point in which, except maybe for the most pure philosophers, right? You need a little bit of fear, right? A little bit of, right? We're not all purists that way. We're not all capable of saying this is the truth and just always doing it. Right? You need a little bit of fear that's really going to keep us at those moments that are hardest. And the only type of fear that you really have in private, b'chadri chadarim, is Yirat Elokim, right? There's something about religion as a civilizing force, right, that nothing else can provide, right? That's his claim. Now, you can agree or disagree with that claim, but I think it's clear, right, that he is, right, I don't know which came first, right? His belief in the cultural moment that there was something missing and responding to it, or he started with the parshanut, right? I assume they played off each other in different ways. Again, I'm not saying this is just polemics. I'm saying, like, sometimes you look at a pshat and a pasuk and it comes to you because of what you've seen in life, right? I don't think... And by the way, this was actually the view of the founders of America. Right. If you look at a lot of the founding fathers, they weren't real believers. They were deists of sorts, many of them. But they write in many of their public and private letters that we have to keep religion a central feature, because the only thing that for most people can keep them moral is religion in its classic sense. Right? Some of them believe they were above that, right, and they didn't need it, like Jefferson and people like that, right? They could be deists and, you know, have some sort of weird religion that didn't have those consequences, but they thought that an average society actually couldn't be civilized without religion, which was part of the drive for the protection of religious liberty and things like that, because they thought it was central to civil society. So this belief is actually shared not just by religious thinkers, but even, you know, not religious thinkers sometimes think that there is a unique power to religion. Kal vachomer, if you believe in it. I would note that the Rav once made a different point. This is recorded in his Shavuos Pesach Svir Saomer book. You know what I'm talking about? You know, the green one, yeah. Anyways, I was sitting with its author at a wedding 2 nights ago, right, Shapiro. I said, I liked the book. He's like, yeah, I was a good high school teacher. I know how to present complicated ideas simply. Which is true. That's what it is. It's an excellent book in that way. And he makes an interesting claim, which is, and this is not exactly what Malbim does, but the Malbim's point I sort of hear, and I'm always a bit torn about, am I really willing to say that religion is the only moralizing force in the world? I don't know if I'm 100% willing to say that. But the point the Rav makes, I am convinced by. The Rav makes the point that one of the unique powers of religion is what he says is the effect of chok on mishpat. Right? Is that the danger of a non-religious system is that when everything is just mishpat, so to speak, right? Eventually, slowly, you can eat away at what was once an obvious moral truth because you can come up with justifications, right? And, you know, as the sort of very cynical joke goes in universities, the the meanest and least ethical people on university staffs tend to be professors of ethics, right? Because you spend your entire time justifying every possible moral theory. You can also justify every immoral thing and, you know, come up with, I don't know, a theory like Ayn Rand and write a book called The Virtue of Selfishness, right? Seriously.
It's a bit of an oxymoron.
No, she thinks that's the only moral philosophy. Like, you can come up with things like this, right? Someone who's an Ayn Rand fan, Ayn Rand technically, Yiddish, one, right, one, will like email me and say, you're terrible, how dare you speak about, whatever. I don't really care about anyone. I don't care. But he says...
That's a pretty ironic name. Did she pick it first?
Yes. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I think it's a pet name.
Uh-huh.
It's
a real book?
Yes.
Oh, it's a real person.
A real person. And a real book.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, her more famous books are Atlas Shrugged and Fountainhead. The Fountainhead.
Yeah,
Anthem
also.
Yeah, I mean, I think the two most. Anyways, doesn't matter.
But
the Rav's point, right, was that the existence of a category called chok is what makes sure that we don't slowly chip away at what's fundamentally a rational law, right? Like, to give modern examples, you have this with, like, right, the debates now about euthanasia, right? About mercy killings, right? The sanctity of human life and that you shouldn't murder, pretty much everyone agrees about. But the question of, well, what happens when, on the margins, when sanctity of life is now called into question by extreme suffering or people who, right, things like that, is human life really that sacred or not? Right, things start to get chipped away at, and then you see, right, you know, in Canada the laws were being introduced when I was living there, and like, it was so rapid, right? It was, you have to allow for assisted suicide. If the doctor doesn't want to do it, he has to grant effective referral. But what's a justification for assisted suicide? So at first it was disease, but eventually, right, I forget if it was in Canada or other countries, and this is what they were worried about, one of the diseases that was legitimate for a reason to bring up, right, bring a request for assisted suicide was depression. Right? Which is crazy already. And then they were like, so first it started with only an adult can do it. But then they said, no, if it's a human right to die, so you should give it even to kids. And they started moving to like 16-year-olds and 14-year-olds. And I don't remember which country did which already. But like, it's crazy that these are actual laws in actual countries, right? And I think the Rav's point I'm totally convinced by, which is even laws, which their core value, their core moral truth can be understood without religion, right? There is something about religion and its, right, and its strictures that grounds those, that makes it that you can't chip away with at it slowly and then more quickly and then more quickly, because it's not just morality, right? There's something else keeping it in place. It's not just human morality, and that point I am convinced by. At any rate, I think that the Malbim's point is at least interesting to think about, because we do live in a similar cultural moment where that really is a big question, which is, can you be moral without any shemets of Yirat Elokim in the divine sense? The Malbim claims not, and that's what's going on in this story. Again, it's something worth thinking about. So he said that's what's going on with Avimelech. Is that Avimelech was a moral person, right? But Avram says, what I was worried about was that I saw that there wasn't really Yirat Elokim. And therefore, I was worried what was going to happen, right? You don't want to commit adultery. But I was worried to say that I was married to her because without Yirat Elokim, so you won't commit adultery, but, you know, what if we cause the husband to die? You know, things, right? The same things by Paro, right? It's, you have certain things, but when I see there's no Yirat Elokim, right? I don't know how that's going, where that's going to go to. And that's what I was worried about, is that, so that was like the half, right, point, is that Hashem is saying to Avimelech, yes, you're somewhat moral, but I'm sending you to Avram to learn that, why he was afraid, why he had to lie, why what you did was not perfectly legitimate. And the answer was, maybe you're somewhat moral, but it's not grounded in a way that Avram felt comfortable that it wasn't going to spin out of control, because there was nothing holding it down. There was nothing, right? That's the way he reads this conversation. Okay?